5-5 West Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Support for a Syrian ceasefire builds. The Syrian government Tuesday announced its acceptance of the proposed U.S.-Russian cessation of hostilities that's to begin Saturday, while cautioning that continued outside assistance to rebels could scuttle the truce. The main Saudi-backed opposition group late Monday agreed to the truce conditionally. In Washington Tuesday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told lawmakers the ceasefire must work.
The only way forward that preserves a unified Syria is the path envisioned by the Syria Support Group, ratified by the U.N. Security Council, and endorsed by the responsible opposition. And that requires a de-escalation of the conflict, a transition to a new system of governance, a new constitution, an election, and hopefully a Syria that could be committed to peace and stability with its neighbors and within itself.
He acknowledged the skepticism voiced by some lawmakers about Russia's commitment and that of Damascus to the ceasefire and hope for political transition.
Assad himself is going to have to make some real decisions about the formation of a transitional governance process that's real. If there isn't, as you've read in the newspapers and are probably hearing, there are certainly Plan B options being considered.
Details of such a Plan B are sketchy, but could involve more direct U.S. and allied military involvement. U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon visited a refugee camp in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo Tuesday, pointing out the growing number of displaced people in the world. The U.N. chief is to meet President Joseph Kabila Wednesday. On Tuesday in Bujumbura, Mr. Ban said President Pierre Nkurunziza agreed to begin talks with the opposition to bring an end to a nearly year-long political crisis. This is VOA News. President Obama Tuesday urged Congress to close the military detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, saying the facility does not advance U.S. national security interests.
It drains military resources. With nearly $450 million spent last year alone to keep it running, and more than $200 million in additional costs needed to keep it open going forward for less than 100 detainees. Guantanamo harms our partnerships with allies and other countries whose cooperation we need against terrorism. Moreover, keeping this facility open is contrary to our values. It undermines our standing in the world. It is viewed as a stain on our broader record of upholding the highest standards of rule of law.
But many lawmakers continue to be opposed to relocation of dozens of terrorist suspects on U.S. soil. The senior U.S. naval officer in the Pacific warned U.S. lawmakers Tuesday that China is building up its military capability in the contested South China Sea. Admiral Harry Harris testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee.
In my opinion, China is clearly militarizing the South China Sea, and you'd have to believe in a flat earth to think otherwise. You know, I think China's SSMs, surface-to-surface missiles, surface-to-air missiles on Woody Allen, its radars, new radars on Quarteron Reef over here, the runway, the 10,000-foot runway on Subi Reef over here, and on Fiery Cross Reef and other places. These are actions that are changing, in my opinion, the operational landscape in the South China Sea.
China, which claims sovereignty over most of the South China Sea, insists these are necessary defensive facilities. New reports indicate China has deployed warplanes to Woody Island in the Paracels, as well as radar systems and surface-to-air missile batteries. The latest development was publicized as Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi held talks with U.S. officials in Washington on South China Sea tensions and North Korea. Direct peace talks between the Afghan government and Taliban-led insurgent groups are expected to start by the first week of March. Pakistan has offered to host negotiations. The announcement followed a meeting Tuesday in Kabul of diplomats from Afghanistan, Pakistan, China, and the U.S., part of the effort to promote the Afghan peace process. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has named a tribunal to investigate the conduct of Supreme Court Judge Philip Tonoi, who faces allegations of corruption. It involves the judge's alleged acceptance of a bribe in the case of the election victory of a Nairobi governor in 2013. Tonoi has professed his innocence. And British nurse Pauline Cafferty is back in a London hospital after recovering twice before from the Ebola virus that she contracted while working as a nurse in Sierra Leone in 2014. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa. From the Voice of America, I'm James Barton in Washington. Today's Wednesday, February 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda's main opposition presidential candidate goes to court to challenge what he calls his illegal detention by the police.
Since Saturday, I'm detained. No one has told me why I'm under detention. I have not been charged with anything. I have not been produced in any court of law. And this is a very critical moment because I'm still a candidate.
Dr. Kizza Besigye is the main opposition presidential candidate of Uganda. Amnesty International says global freedoms and human rights are under threat. Scientists say they are a step closer to total prevention of HIV transmission. And South Sudan's government says it is ready to form a national unity government with the rebels.
We have agreed that day the partners and donors transport the SPLA-IO forces of 1,370 before the end of this month, so that by the first week of March, the Tuareg Machar comes in and the Transitional Government of National Unity is established.
Michael Makui is South Sudan's information minister, and cashew nuts production is booming in the Ivory Coast. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Uganda's main opposition presidential candidate, Dr. Kizza Besigye, says he has asked his lawyers to challenge in a court of law what he called his continued illegal detention by the police. Besigye of the Forum for Democratic Change said he has been in and out of police detention since last Saturday without being charged. He said police have told him that as long as they believe he is a danger to the country, they will continue to hold him whether their action is within the law or not. Mr. Besigye has challenged past Ugandan elections before. He said, while he does not have confidence in the Ugandan judicial system, it is an option available to him, but which he is not being allowed to exercise.
Last night, I was dropped back from the police cells of Nagalama, which is in a neighboring district, and I found my home still besieged. And I was told to get into my home and not allowed to get out. So I was inquiring why they removed me from the gazetted cells to bring me to imprison me in my home, which is not a gazetted prison. But no one is interested in answering. No charge, no explanation, no documentation. And I was brought back to my besieged home. This time, I invited my lawyers to be at home and some journalists to witness that I actually haven't been released. In other words, I have been under police detention since Saturday. So that's why I invited my lawyers to come over tonight to witness what is going on. So I have instructed them to take the matter now to the courts of law so that I am produced in court and a charge is either leveled against me or whatever fate is decided by the court.
Dr. Besigye, when you say you have instructed your lawyers to take the matters to the court, what matter are you taking to the court? Your detention or the election?
Of illegal detention. Because as I have told you, since Saturday, I'm detained. No one has told me why I'm under detention. I have not been charged with anything. I have not been produced in any court of law. And this is a very critical moment because I am still a candidate in the 2016 elections because, as I pointed out earlier to you, I have the option of petitioning the Supreme Court to challenge the outcome of the 2016 election. It is the Supreme Court that has the final say on the elections, and the Supreme Court has power to declare me as a winner, depending on the evidence I produced before it, or to cancel the election and order for the election.
Dr. Besigye, do you have confidence in the Ugandan Supreme Court?
No, I don't. But it's an option that I have, which I'm not being allowed to exercise.
Did the police tell you, Dr. Besigye, why they are putting you in police custody during the day and after nightfall they bring you back?
Absolutely nothing. No documentation, no release bond, no nothing. Just acting forcefully as they do. They take me by force to the prison. They remove me from prison by force and bring me back home and continue doing the same. Nobody talks to me about why. The only thing we hear from Indeed, what they tell the media is that they have intelligence information that if I get into Kampala, there will be commotion, and that therefore they will not allow me to go to town to cause problems. But even if that was the case, it doesn't give them power to detain me endlessly without any charge.
Dr. Kizza Besigye is the presidential candidate of Uganda's main opposition forum for democratic change. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. The South Sudan government says it has agreed with the opposition to form a transitional government of national unity by the first week of next month. Information Minister Michael Makwei says the two sides have agreed to form the government now and resolve remaining issues later, like the number of states in the country. Mugumi Davis Rakarinja has more for VOA from Juba.
Michael Makwei emerged from today's JMEC meeting to say that the two sides have agreed to end their standoff.
Despite the 28 states, despite the absence of the constitution, we said all these issues are issues that will be discussed and resolved by the transitional government of national unity. So it is not an issue at present.
President Salva Kiir announced the establishment of 28 states at the end of last year. Regional bodies, IGAD and the African Union, have called on the two sides to implement the August peace deal and work out the remaining issues after the new government is in place. Earlier this month, President Kiir appointed Riek Machar to be first vice president and ordered him to report the capital Juba within 1 week. But Machar says he'll only come to Juba once security arrangements as outlined in the peace agreement have been made. Makwei says that matter was resolved in today's meeting.
Well, what I tell the people of South Sudan is that we are in the process. The government is committed to the implementation of the agreement, and we have agreed with the SPLMA, IO, and our partners and donors now that day, the partners and donors transport the SPLA, IO forces of 1,370 before the end of this month, so that by the first week of March, the Riek Machar comes in and the transitional government of national unity established.
The government and armed opposition have signed several ceasefire agreements since fighting broke out in December 2013, but both sides have violated those agreements. The fighting has displaced at least 2.8 million people and forced thousands to flee for refugee in neighboring countries, mainly Uganda, Kenya, and Ethiopia. The UN has warned of a looming famine in South Sudan unless the fighting ends immediately, which would allow people to return their farms and grow food. Makwei says he's optimistic the suffering of citizens will finally come to an end.
It means that for our people, it is to assure them that we are in the process of implementing the agreement, and as soon as the Tigono is established, some of these outstanding issues will definitely be addressed by the transitional government of national unity.
A spokesman in Riek Machar's office was not available for comment. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
Amnesty International today, Wednesday, released its annual report, and much of the human rights concerns in Western Central Africa are linked to terrorism, both the threat posed to civilians by terrorists, but also the sometimes repressive response to this threat by governments. Steve Colburn, Deputy Regional Director for Research for Western Central Africa, tells Ricky Stryak that while regional governments and security forces have the right and obligation to fight terrorism, Amnesty is calling for a more focused response to that threat.
2015 was an extremely difficult year across the globe, especially in Western Central Africa. The most worrying trend that we saw for human rights has been the expansion of armed groups and terrorist organizations across the region. We started 2015 with the news of a terrible attack on the town of Baga in Nigeria, which killed hundreds, if not thousands, of people. And we started 2016 with the news of the killing by ACMI of 30 people in Ouagadougou, including two colleagues of Amnesty International. In between that, the types of suicide bombings, attacks on civilians. So civilians have really been hit by the expansion of armed groups. At the same time, they've often been caught between a rock and a hard place, between the actions of armed groups and the sometimes quite repressive measures taken by governments to respond to that. This has included mass and arbitrary detentions of civilians. It included the detention of children, the number of extrajudicial killings in countries such as Cameroon and Nigeria.
I know I've heard in Nigeria, especially when it comes to Boko Haram, one of the things the government is doing is detaining children.
And we see this in Nigeria. We've also documented in Cameroon. During operations to identify Boko Haram suspects, the security forces may enter villages or parts of towns and arrest largely young men, but also boys, often on the information just of one local informant. They would be detained for well over a year in quite horrendous condition. We did a report this year in Nigeria that showed that over 7,000 people had died in military detention in military prisons in Nigeria since 2012. Through starvation, through illnesses, through disease. We saw the same in Cameroon this year. We documented a case where a Quranic school had been raided. The teachers were beaten. They were taken to prison where they still are. And there was 84 children, half of whom were less than 10 years old, were taken to a sort of children's center and detained there away from their parents for 6 months without any charges. They were eventually released, but it showed to us that it was an example of how a measure that was supposed to be targeting would-be terrorists and supposed members of armed groups was often taken in a very wide and blunt and heavy-handed measure. There was children as young as 5 years old there who, you know, when we talk to them, they tell us they want to play football for Manchester United. None of them talked about wanting to be terrorists.
Is there a concern that there is not the training or the resources, though, in many of these countries to actually carry these out in a more targeted and less sweeping manner?
Countries like Cameroon and Nigeria do have units of very highly skilled, specialized, and well-equipped troops in that area. But at the same time, many of the violations that we have discovered have not been because of a lack of training.
Steve Colburn is Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for Research for Western Central Africa. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar, Senegal. Today's Wednesday, February 24th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Still to come, Marco Oman Sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 17 minutes past the hour. Scientists in Africa say they have taken a step closer to total prevention of HIV transmission. Researchers have been studying a vaginal ring containing an antiretroviral drug. Sebastian Mofu reports from Zimbabwe's capital, Harare.
Research findings reveal the dapivirin ring inserted into a woman's genital tract and used for a month at a time reduced the risk of HIV infection by 27% overall. The study, known as ASPIRE, a study to prevent infection with a ring for extended use, was conducted in Malawi, Uganda, South Africa, and Zimbabwe. More than 2,600 women took part in the study between 2012 and 2014. Zimbabwean researcher Felix Mhlanga has coined a phrase, there's hope in ASPIRE.
There is hope in the sense that we got a prevention agent that is able to avert 1 in 3 infections. We also have hope in the sense that if funds permit, then we should look at, can this ring be taken into full production for use? A lot of the infections are occurring in young women, 60% of them. For once, they have a product that they can use, and you don't really need to explain it to other people. It's not like a condom, which is, you know, you have to negotiate with your partner.
Mhlanga is one of the researchers from the University of Zimbabwe, University of California, San Francisco Collaborative Research Program in Women's Health. The U.S. National Institute of Health funded the research. In a second trial called the Ring Study, HIV risk was reduced by 31% overall and by 37% among participants older than 21. HIV activist Tari Rokutadza said those results make her concerned those under 21 would not use the ring effectively.
I think it's about their attitude. They want to take things like fashion, you know, fashion. Maybe we should have the ring and we should develop another option so that when they are tired using their ring, they can use the another thing. I think that's with the young people. That's where I'm worried, the age group, which means to say we still have a lot of work to do.
Any progress in defeating HIV transmission would be welcome in Zimbabwe and the countries nearby. Estimates say out of the 34 million HIV-positive people worldwide, 69% live in sub-Saharan Africa. Sebastian Mhofu for VOA News, Harare.
Ivory Coast is cashing in on cashew nuts. Over the past 10 years, the country increased its production by 400% and recently overtook India as the world's top cashew nut producer. But the sector remains challenged by the lack of domestic processing capacity, which impacts its revenues. Emily Yop reports from Abidjan.
The harvest has just started, but the mood is good among cashew farmers in Ivory Coast. This year again, the government announced an increase in the minimum selling prices. Raymond Kouakou, a former real estate agent, started planting cashew trees in his home village back in 1999.
My friend told me that cashew production could put food on the table. He encouraged me to start.
But the development of the budding industry was put on hold until 2011 as the West African nation entered multiple political crises. Now the sector is growing again thanks to increasing global demand. National production almost doubled in the last 5 years alone to reach 25% of the global output, making Ivory Coast the world's top producer ahead of India and Vietnam. The government played a major role in developing and regulating the sector by setting control and minimum prices through the same group that also regulates cotton production. Producer and buyer Aruna Konate says it helped a lot.
Borders were very porous. Our product would go to the neighboring countries. And there were also a lot of speculation because we didn't really know what was the global market price for cashew. But now, thanks to Cotton Cashew Council, it's all right.
However, Ivory Coast only processes about 6% of its total cashew production. The nuts are sent to Asia to be processed, then sold to consumers in the US and in Europe. For Cotton Cashew Council Director Malamine Sanogo, increasing domestic processing is the next key step to developing the industry.
We believe that if we domestically process the cashew, we should be able to increase the farm gate prices by 80% if I compare to other countries.
Sanogo says the Ivorian government plans to domestically process all of its cashew production by 2020. Emilia Yap for VOA News in Abidjan.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Jordan's FIFA presidential election candidate, Prince Ali Al Hussein, filed an urgent appeal in support of the use of transparent polling booths and independent scrutineers at Friday's poll, the Court of Arbitration in Sports, CAS, disclosed in Lausanne, Switzerland on Tuesday. The appeal follows the rejection of the proposal by the FIFA ad hoc election committee. CAS will give its verdict by tomorrow, Thursday. Meanwhile, South African Sports and Recreation Deputy Minister Gert Oosthuizen reckons South Africa will bag more medals in Rio de Janeiro than ever before at any Olympics and Paralympics. I caught up with him at the Best Made Road Race in the South African capital Tshwane, where he offered an insight as to why he graces this annual event.
If you look at the vision and the mission of the Department of Sport and Recreation, it's to create an active and a winning nation, to foster social cohesion. You find that sport has the power to really unite people. It's a language, you know, that transcends all barriers. This Best Marathon, half marathon, started 5 years ago, and we had 2,000 people that entered. Yeah, this year, we're close to 17,000 people. And if you look around, you see the Rainbow Children of Nelson Mandela participating this morning. I'm here because we are really actively supporting partnerships, private sector, institutions of excellence, creating opportunities for people to live and practice an active and healthy lifestyle, the children to play in the theme park today.
This is an Olympic year. What are your expectations from your Olympians this year?
We have high expectations because our Sports Confederation and Olympic Committee went through with the federations a very stringent selection process. We ensured that we get the athletes that are qualifying and we put them in a high performance center and nurture them and ensure that wherever we send them, they will really be able to compete at the world stage. We have high expectations of them and of the Paralympics. We have a very strong Paralympic team. Our focus is to say we want to normalize society. Hence, this morning you would have seen people in wheelchairs participating in the marathons. You know, we have role models in that field. Ernst van Dijk is a well-known wheelchair racer. The sports movement in this country has the expectation to have a better medal count this year around than we've had in the previous Olympic Games.
That was Gert Ostwezen, South African Deputy Minister of Sports and Recreation, speaking in Tshwane, South Africa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for a Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 24th. On this day, 1864, Rebecca Lee became the first black woman to receive a degree as a medical doctor. Also on this day, 1867, Howard University in Washington, D.C. was created by Congress. On this day, 1940, former world heavyweight boxing champion Jimmy Ellis was born, James Albert Ellis, in Louisville, Kentucky. Ellis won the World Boxing Association title after beating Jared Quarry in April of 1968. Did you know that Granville T. Woods was a 19th century inventor known as the Black Thomas Edison for his electrical engineering? Woods was born a free man on April 23, 1856, in Columbus, Ohio. He taught himself electrical and mechanical engineering while working in railroad machine shops and steel mills. In 1887, Woods developed a device he called synchronous multiplex railway telegraph. The device not only helped dispatchers locate trains, it also allowed moving trains to communicate by telegraph. On this day in African history, in 1966, Kwame Nkrumah, the first president of Ghana, was removed by the military. He was out of the country on a peace mission to Vietnam in Southeast Asia. Also on this day in African history, in 1961, Dr. Louis Leakey discovered human-like bones in the Olduvai Gorge in Tanganyika, which is today Tanzania. The bones are believed to be the ancestors of modern man. And on this day in African history, 1949, after 42 days of bitter debate, Egypt and Israel signed an armistice on the island of Rhodes. However, several contentious topics, such as the status of Beersheba in the Negev Desert, were dropped from the final agreement. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 24th. Congratulations to Teriem Gwaza of Abuja, Nigeria, and Michael T. Biddle of the Carter Center Liberia Field Office. You are the winners of our February 23rd question. What NBA team did Julius Winfield Irving or Dr. J play for? The answer, the Philadelphia 76ers. Now, here is our question for today, February 24th. Who is considered as the first female African-American millionaire? Once again, who is considered as the first female African millionaire? Send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address.
Don't give up the fight. Don't give it up. Don't give it up. Get up. Stand up. Get up. Stand up. Stand up for your right.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Amnesty International, today is Wednesday, released its annual report, and much of the human rights concerns in Western Central Africa are linked to terrorism, both the threat posed to civilians by terrorists, but also the sometimes repressive response to this threat by governments. Steve Colburn, Deputy Regional Director for Research for West Africa and Central Africa, says that while regional governments and security forces have the right and obligation to fight terrorism, Amnesty is calling for a more focused response to that threat. That's it for this Wednesday, February 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Ullman, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We'll discuss the beauty of Africa with me, Esther Githui-Ewart, as guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.